I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go into the Super Bowl again, being all right.
You're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast, the official UK podcast for the Seattle Seahawks. Here are your hosts, Ross Bell, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan. Go Hawks!
Hello and welcome back to the Pedestrian Podcast with the Seahawks. 10 days or so away from reconvening at VMAC for training camp. We saw it fit that we just off the summer sun cobwebs and return to look back on what has been an interesting and eventful off-season for these Seahawks. Ross is somewhere doing his night shift at the one of our country supermarkets. So it's myself, Stuart Court, joined by Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm not bad, mate. I'll pull back the curtain. It's about 12:30 night or AM, whatever you want to call it. And normally I sort of address tricky podcasts with a rather large glug of whiskey in my side. This one probably, if it wasn't so late, I'd need the bottle for, because I think it's going to be a bit of a sobering one. But let's see how we get on.
Yeah, with training camp just a few days away, as I said, it's a time to be positive about sport. So should we just talk about Harry Kane and Coughlin at Wembley then, yeah?
Yeah, and even that went up shit creek without a paddle. well, not less so Coventry. But yeah, I mean, nothing's right in the world, Stu. Let's be honest with that with ourselves.
No.
Let's use that as our base to build off, and we'll see how we go from there.
Yeah, if you want your hour or so of positivity, you're probably best waiting a couple of weeks.
Yeah, after that cheery start.
We'll go all the way back to the end of April and the NFL draft. Yes, it has been that long since we last did a podcast. The Seahawks entered with no second round pick and no third round pick because of interesting decisions made in the draft in 2017. Sheldon Richardson and Dwayne Brown put pay to second and third round pick, and then they came on the clock in the first round, traded back as they always do, because the Packers traded up for, is it Leighton Van Der Bosch? I can't remember who they traded up for, but they traded up for someone. And then the Seahawks did what the Seahawks always do and threw something out of, right wing for something we're going to get to later, and drafted San Diego State running back Rashad Penny. Rashad Penny, for all of, I mean, initially it was something which I've definitely talked myself into rather than was on board from the get-go, but his stats, and even at a school which isn't obviously a powerhouse at San Diego State, it kind of makes more sense what 3 months on it did initially. Or is it still one you need to be sold on with Penny, Adam?
I guess it's twofold. If you subscribe to the view that the coaching staff are right in their philosophy and what they want to do, and they just want to, you know, ground and pound and run the ball and that sort of pretty tired cliche of getting back to Seahawk football, whatever that actually means, then I guess you have to be for it. I'm someone who spent a lot of last season reading people like Ben Baldwin and Nathan Ernst, who came on and did a great podcast with us last season. And personally, I'm completely, well, maybe not completely, but I'm pretty against the idea that running the ball, or and certainly who you have running the ball, is what makes the difference. And I think that there are a number of other positions of need that would suggest that the individual is more valuable to the position than running back. And so I'm not for the move, and I probably never will be for the move. That said, he seems like obviously a really good player, and it might work in isolation. But when you start reading statistics that suggest that Leonard Fournette and Ezekiel Elliott actually may not have been that good a pick for the position they were taken, it's hard for me to subscribe to us taking a running back in the first round.
Yeah, in the draft class that we're about, which was Saquon Barkley and the rest, there is a couple of stats measured by Pro Football Focus where Rashad Penny was ahead of the Saquon, or Saquad, as he's become known in the last few weeks. He was number one in the country on percentage of runs where he was not tackled on first contact, with 42.8% of his runs when he was hit, he carried on after first contact, which is always a good sign for a Seahawks running back with our offensive line. And 57.6% of his runs were breakaway runs. I'm not too sure what that means, and that again was ranked number one. He is the first San Diego State running back to be selected in the first round since Marshall Faulk, and he's just the third Seahawks. He's just the third running back the Seahawks have ever taken in the first round after Kurt Warner and Sean Alexander. I mean, those three names, Faulk, Warner and Alexander, it's not bad company to be in, is it?
No, certainly not. I mean, the counter, I guess, is that those guys probably had a lot better lines to run behind and was probably the most important player on the team at the time, whereas everything that you read currently would suggest that the most important player on the team has to be Russell Wilson, and throwing is more important than running. I do wonder if it would have been different had Derwin James not been taken by the LA Chargers at 17, because that seemed like a position, especially, you know, what would the team probably know that Cam Chancellor was done. God knows what's going on with Earl Thomas at the time. Even at the draft, it seemed pretty dicey. So it's one of those I have to, you know, hope they'll eat my words and, you know, he'll, you know, have 2,000 yards from scrimmage. But, you know, if he doesn't have, let's say, 1,500 all-purpose yards from scrimmage in his first year, I think you probably have to say it wasn't a good pick. And that's actually an awful lot of pressure to put on a guy, because it's pretty implausible that he could do that.
No, yeah, especially with how much we spent the last 10 months or so talking about how much Pete Carroll seemed to be infatuated with Chris Carson, who was a seventh round pick, and he seems in pretty good nick heading into training camp a few days away. So there is a lot of undue pressure, but if you read in the stat sheet, it doesn't seem too bad, and I have very definitely turned around on Penny, and he's also been the first pick in both of my dynasty drafts this year, so that says something. The next pick after that was Rasheen Green, a defensive end from USC. He's raw, he's young, but he appears to have a lot of the tools that work. But with the absence of Michael Bennett and what ended up being a few weeks ago, the absence announced of with the departure, the loss of Cliff Averill, it's going for someone raw with at that position, again, is a bit of a risk, isn't it?
Yeah, and he doesn't look the biggest. I mean, he seems like a guy that's going to have to put on a few pounds in order to do that role. We'll come on to this in the, you know, as the pod continues, and most people will probably know I'm not the most hopeful going into the season. And, you know, if it gives a guy, you know, with potential an opportunity to play a ton going into 2019... which was my sort of target for the whole draft this year, was to focus on 2019, then that's okay. But I mean, I'm certainly not expecting this guy to be, you know, if he gives us like a Naz Jones-esque rookie year, I think we'd take that with two hands.
Yeah, I'd agree. Round four was the pick of the best blocking tight end. So I think Karen Schneider called Will Disley, who's a former defensive end, I think he was at Washington, wasn't he? He converted to a tight end. A blocking tight end in the fourth round is, after a running back in the first, it's they're not exactly being coy with their hand this year, are they, with what they want to do in 2018?
No, I mean, you probably know what Carroll was holding in a poker game if you were sitting across the table at the minute. I think he's... you know, you'd probably see the reflection of the two aces in his eyeballs shining off him.
Although there is a very good chance he's got a two and a seven at the same time as well.
Well, that's what I probably think he's got. I mean, and I've got to say, they're not both spades either. it's a pick that adds to the philosophy of the team, and if you sign up to the philosophy, then it's a good move. I guess the hope is that with Mike Solari there, that will obviously make a huge improvement to the offensive line and how they run block and things like that. And again, you know, I guess the point is, if they're going to have a philosophy, whether I agree with it or not, they might as well double down on it and properly go for it, because they've probably got themselves caught out in the last couple of years by fusing philosophies. And when people like Richard Sherman say the Seahawks have lost their way, it is a bit of bitterness, but there is certainly an element of truth that you could say that there hasn't really been, you know, what has the philosophy of the team been in the last 3 years? So at least they've clearly got one this year. It just so happens to be one that I don't particularly subscribe to.
Yeah, it could be a case of after the horse has bolted slightly with what the Seahawks try to do. And then the pick after Disley was probably the pick that got the most attention of the Seahawks draft, and also probably one of the best stories to come out of this NFL draft and draft season and the last couple of college seasons as well. Central Florida linebacker Shaquem Griffin, the twin brother of Seahawks third round pick in 2017, Shaquille. But outside of playing, that is something that's going to be seen if he can make the transition to the NFL with all everything, a fifth round pick. They're not slam dunks, even in a world, in a team where they have fifth round picks, including Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor last year. But outside of that, it was a pretty cool moment, and pretty cool that with all the negativity that has come out of the building in certain junctures this offseason, that it was the Seahawks who made the pick and were at the core and the centre of this story with Shaquem, wasn't it?
It was fantastic. And, you know, I think you mentioned during the draft period that you think that other teams had sort of let that pick happen. And I think you're probably right. Whether or not other teams had a fifth round grade on him, I don't know. And I guess now he's just got to make the team. And if he does make the team, it's where does he play? Suggestions would be that he'd be, you know, a linebacker and a special teams,
phenom.
Yeah, a real special teams guy. So, you know, if you can get that from a fifth round pick, then you take it.
Yeah, definitely. It will be interesting to see how he lines up and how, there's a very good chance that he will be number 53 on the 50th for Freeman roster at the end of August. Then came Trey Flowers, who was a safety at Oklahoma State, and the team are converting him to cornerback, as they did last year with Mike Tyson. Jamarco Jones was also a pick in the fifth round. Jacob Martin was a pick in the sixth round. Alex McGough, the Seahawks and the John Schneider finally drafted another quarterback, Florida International, who looks like he's got quite a good arm and could be quite a good backup, not named Austin Davis. But the one that's got, after Shaquem Griffin, probably got most attention is the other fifth round pick, which is Michael Dixon, the Australian punter out of Texas, who was called the best ever punter to play college football, who kicks the balls in inventive and special and unique ways. But after an off-season of change for Seahawks, this is the last rung of the change, isn't it? Because it appears that Dixon is going to push John Ryan on out of the picture and out of Seattle and out of the VMAC, doesn't it?
Yeah, and look, special teams is obviously a very important part of the game, and you know the team are always very excited about special teams. And in a way, you know, this is going to be hypocritical because I spent 12 months last year lambasting Blair Walsh for being a prick. But it does make me laugh a little bit when you see fans, you know, they're talking about how optimistic they are for the new season. They're like, we've restocked with young talent. The kicking game is going to be much better. And that's like the second thing that they go for why this season is going to be better. And it should be really good that this guy can belt the ball, you know, into Portland. And hopefully he can do it every time and great, you know, have great field position for us. But ultimately, if the offense and the defense can't really get their act together, as great as it will be, no one's going to want the punter to be the player of the year next year. As delighted as I am to have this guy who, you know, you would hope that it's the most transferable skill of all, just punting from college to the NFL. Let's hope that the kicking game isn't the second most optimistic thing we have to be about as the season goes on.
It's a very viable chance that it will be. But yeah, overall though, the Seahawks did end up with a lot more picks than probably many people expected them to have. Obviously, it's a few months removed. Any lasting feelings as the class begins working next week or so, Adam, or just wait and see on everyone? And
I think it's a wait and see. I mean, two guys I was pretty disappointed to lose in free agency, and this is probably just maybe partly nostalgia, but also because I think they were decent role players, people like Luke Wilson and Deshaun Shedd, both of whom I thought in an off-season of real change could have been quite handy guys to have around. And I think I hope that people like Will Disley can fill the role that Luke Wilson filled. And his name just escapes me. The safety's moved to cornerback. Hopefully he can do...
Trey Flowers.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully Trey Flowers can sort of do what Deshaun Shedd was doing. I find it pretty hard to be that optimistic or that buzzing about the draft. There's no one that, you know, aside from the great story of Shaquem Griffin, there's no one that you'd be like, I can't wait to go and get his jersey or something like that. But then how optimistic have we been about that many drafts for a little while? So... there's in my opinion, there's quite a big quality gap in the roster from where it needs to be. But they wasn't a lot they could do about it given they had no second and no third round pick. And I guess you just have to go into the season and hope they can make it work somehow.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with all that. I think the one pick I really did like was Jamarcus Jones. I really liked him out of Ohio State. He just does not give up any ground in pass. He's not the most overpowering of players. But
what have you just done there?
I just need to drop my microphone. Why?
Because it just sounded... I just knew that carnage had ensued on the other end of the microphone.
Yeah, bring some light-hearted,
you know, how the sausage is made to the pod.
Yeah, hopefully it's still recording me. This Jamarcus Jones could be the name to watch after he plays all five positions in preseason, most likely with the Seahawks offensive line approach. Also, enjoying all that draft talk, you did mention Mike Solari, and that's like the first time I've heard his name in like 5 months. That's refreshing, isn't it?
It always helps not to be talking about an offensive line coach, and it's very nice that someone else will have the most underrated coach in the NFL.
And that I've just spent £300 to see him.
Yeah, and I spent £500 to see him. So pipe down and carry on.
Yeah. But after the draft, the Seahawks were not quiet for long. Cliff Averill first was the first to... Well, did he retire? Or was he, I'm not going to be back? And then he signed his deal to be a host on KJR. I can't really remember how that worked. But
I think he
Cliff
retired first.
Yeah, Cliff Averill hung up the cleats after suffering a stinger in week 3 on Monday Night Football against the Indianapolis Colts, which was just an absolute nothing play where I think Jacoby Brissett's heel went into his chin and ended his career. It's mad how Amy Carr crashes the rounds, which he showed me his put, and that's what ended someone's a Pro Bowler's career. And then a few weeks ago, Cam Chancellor seemed to suggest the end was nigh for him. While he's still on the roster, he's still being paid, which what he's due, you can't really blame him. So still want to be on the roster and not want to walk away from that. He announced that the NFL will not see him on the field again either. But obviously the biggest takeaway for me, I think for you and a lot of people, was what he said in his statement, how he signed his retirement statement off, Adam.
Yeah, we can't seem to find it because he's actually deleted all of his social media, which is a bit of a shame, but I'm sure there's a reason for that. But it was something like, pray for your boy. I don't know how these injuries are going to affect me in the future, but, you know, he's hoping that I can be okay. Chancellor is an emotional guy and always has been very, you know, passionate with his words. So I guess the hope for that would be that, he doesn't know what's going to happen and this is the worst case scenario he's been given. But, you know, there's a reason why it's such a dangerous sport and there's so many problems for retired players, and that's because stuff like this happens. And let's not forget, this happened in a complete nothing play at the end of the Cardinals game that was over at this stage. I mean, that field in Arizona has put pay to probably the dynasty of the Seahawks in Super Bowl 49. It's seen the end of Richard Sherman as a Seahawk and the end of Cam Chancellor as a Seahawk. I mean, it's grim to think about, but it's just unbelievable how many things have happened in that stadium that have done us in. And I've just remembered that you're going to see them play in Arizona next year. So yep. God knows what that's going to cough up.
Yeah, I completely forgot that was where 49 was. Oh, Jesus. Oh, yeah. Okay. I might be going SeatGeek later, signing all my ticket.
Yeah, it's a bit of an elephant graveyard for the team, that stadium, unfortunately.
Yeah, I just wonder after today's news if Steve Kime will allow the sales of alcohol to get through that.
That is very true.
Yeah, but yeah, it is the next it's the next nail in the coffin of the last 5 or 6 years of the Seahawks. It is very unnerving when you read that. I think we spoke to Michael Sean Dugar on Twitter when it broke. It was just that's that. If anything will throw into doubt the long term future of the sport, we watch for 20 weeks a year and follow for 365 days a year, then that statement will be put up in the art gallery once that nail on the coffin in that sport is done. That would be seen as the butterfly landing on the chest. Do you think if it continues in the way the sport appears to be going?
Yeah, I mean, look, they're trying different things like the kickoff laws to try and alleviate hits. I mean, if the league itself is trying to limit the number of hits players are taking, then at some point it's going to have to be a lot more introspective as to the problems of the actual game, as opposed to just changing one or two minor things to stop, you know, if a player's getting hit 50 times a game, then getting hit 51 times, you know, is still going to be that's the main problem. I've said, you know, in passing for a while to people that, you know, I think maybe at some point the helmet will have to go because it's used as too much of a defense mechanism, or you know, it's a cloak of immortality for players. And it's used as a weapon, which they're going to try and stop, and that's going to cause ejections and quite a bit of carnage, I think, this season. But I think you'd have to be, have your head very much buried in the sand if you didn't think that there's, you know, a problem in the game that is going to have to probably see, you know, big changes to it in the probably not too distant future.
Yeah. And obviously, the big people like LeBron James, high profile athletes in other sports, have also said that, saying things like they're not going to let their kids play the sport. But you see then what we're going to get into a bit later with people like Earl Thomas and Le'Veon Bell in Pittsburgh, and pretty much most of the players who were given the franchise tag, they're chasing the money. And really, when you read things like what Cam Chancellor said, when you see things like Tyler Helinski, obviously we're going to be doing a lot for in a couple of weeks and months, it kind of side more with the players that they're making the money to try and set everyone up. And even if the quality of life is a massive part of their reasoning, it's somewhere deep down, isn't it? The quality of life after the game is probably the reason they're chasing the money, they're chasing the big deals, and they feel so slighted by not getting it and the lack of guaranteed deals the NFL offers and has.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really deny the problems now. And no. As much as the league obviously are terrified of all the stuff being revealed, they're going to have to change more things than just you're not allowed to have a running start from kickoffs. Because, you know, Ricardo Lockett aside, the majority of the injuries seem to happen on a lot more nondescript moments than the kickoff, to be honest.
Yeah. There's Eric Legrand, I think his name was, at Rutgers. He's paralysed. I think he won all sorts of ESPY awards for the work he's done. He was paralysed about 4 or 5 years ago on a kickoff as well. So there has been some examples of it, but yeah, the D-Day for the sport and the game is coming, and it's not just because of what a treasonous president may or may not be tweeting. Outside of that, there was a few interesting visitors to VMAC over the course of the off-season. Adam, before we go into that, I did want to throw something at you. If Cam Chancellor is retiring, which he seems to be, is what would be the, obviously, Super Bowl 48, you've got the Vernon Davis hit. Outside of that, what is the one thing, one play, soundbite that you'd remember Cam for? Or is it just being, as John Ryan said in Jason Jenks' athletic piece, the best leader and greatest leader he's ever been around?
It's easy for me. It's easy. It's the pick six against Cam Newton in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I've literally watched that like 10 times this week trying to find a decent soundbite.
Again, time. Near side, intercepted! It's intercepted by Chancellor! Touchdown!
It was such a thrilling game. It was proper like Seahawk football, where we just, Marshawn Lynch had a few real trademark runs in that game, and to seal it with something like that. And bear in mind, you know, about an hour and a half beforehand, he was leaping over the line three times.
Field goals.
That was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
That game was probably the epitome of him, and it really, really summed him up. I'll be honest in this and say that he lost me a little bit with the holdout, and that's, you know, I'm not saying that I'm right in thinking that, and, you know, players have the right to do whatever they want, but he didn't impress me particularly when he missed two games, and I think that was the start of, you know, quite a few problems. But he had every right to do it, and I don't blame him for doing it, and he got his money afterwards, so obviously it worked out for him. But at that point, it was probably my favourite player.
Yeah, It's shot out of a cannon. The call from whoever the guy is who worked with John Lynch back then on Fox is just brilliant. It's like, he is legitimately shot out of a cannon, and it's just the best way. Is everything, CenturyLink field and the lights, see CenturyLink bouncing like it was during those few years as well. He was quite, but also there's little plays like he had at Arizona when he tore through the right tackle and made a stop immediately on David Johnson after he flipped out two players. Like, it's just, he was just a player like the Seahawks haven't had and haven't got anymore. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how they replace him. Over his Seahawks career, since being a fifth round pick in 2010, he started 93 games with 12 interceptions, 50 pass breakups, which is quite impressive, 9 forced fumbles, 3 fumble recoveries, and that one touchdown and 2 sacks as well, and 434 tackles, which is probably something he is in a few years he may probably will regret. As I said before, I'll jump back onto Cam Chancellor. There's been some interesting happenings at VMAC for non-footballing reasons, which set me into a bit of a tailspin, which I think you enjoyed a bit more than you did the fact that this guy was in at the VMAC. But after all the talk of that the team wanted to quiet down the locker room and trading away Michael Bennett, cutting Richard Sherman, who is already back on the field before Earl Thomas is back in Seattle, which is annoying. Jordan Peterson visited with the team. Pete Carroll's tweet got a lot of attention, not positive, which is rightly often the case when Jordan Peterson is involved, Adam.
Yeah, he's a guy I've come across. I listened to a few American podcasts in the past, and it was pretty obvious that he's just a misogynistic prick, to be honest, amongst other things. As I can't really think of any other way to put him, to be quite honest.
No.
And just to see that tweet that he was at the VMAC, yeah, that I cannot think of a single feature, redeeming feature that he's got that any Seahawk player would pick up, something that I respect from what he said. And, you know, Seahawk Twitter can be a lively place at times, and there's plenty of, you know, differing opinion, and some people like this and some people like that. I would say that every single person I respect that I've ever read a tweet from on Seahawk Twitter was outraged at him being there, and I think that pretty much sums it up. It was a very weird thing to do, and I know you've had a look at a few of his talks and whatever. He's the kind of guy that says outrageous things in a very calm voice, and so whilst he pisses people off and causes them to raise their voice against him, he comes across as, you know, the calm, more measured one, when actually he's just being a twat.
Yeah, his message gets through by furore of others. He has refused to admit once that men might be in charge. He believes that men might be in charge because they are better at it, saying that the people who hold that our culture is an oppressive patriarchy, they don't want to admit that the current hierarchy might be predicated on competence. Someone once said in a Guardian article that he is as close to a white nationalist as you could get. His cultural Marxism stance and the arc of radicalization often passes through these moderate ideologies. And with, as I said, with the way I lined up the Jordan Peterson topic, it's not a great looking juxtaposition for the team and for Pete Carroll, who's made some big, ballsy and possibly not the most popular decisions with some of his players for reasons, which is on the opposite side of things and the way that Mr. Peterson sees the world, Adam.
But it's not even players. Like, the Seahawks lost a game in Tennessee, and I would say they lost against Tennessee because they played as poorly as they generally played for the whole season. They weren't a good team last year, and they lost because the offensive line was crap. They couldn't run. Wilson was off, as he was many times away from home. And it was just a pretty typical Seahawk game against a moderately good team.
Yeah.
Carroll came out and said, you know, we don't want that to happen again because the Trump stuff from the night before, you know, it affected our preparation and we didn't go out in the right mindset. I find that a pretty tricky one to stomach, I have to say,
because especially lined up with how everything's come out of Philadelphia since their Super Bowl win, and how Doug Peterson dealt with all that stuff. But they had Malcolm Jenkins, Chris Long donated his season game check to people who needed it more than him, obviously, and they dealt with it and they carried on regardless and went on to win a Super Bowl. We had that in Tennessee, which is the biggest bugbear of the year, and it appears that it kind of clouded everything is coming the 8-9 months since, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. And you know, they traded Michael Bennett, they got rid of Richard Sherman, and you know, I hate this phrase of talking about sort of like, you know, closing off the noise coming out of the locker room. The Philadelphia Eagles are heroes of America, if you ask me. The way in which they carried themselves, the issues they stood for, they deserve to be seen as heroes of America. My favorite podcast is Dave Damashek, and he says, you know, America's team shouldn't be a title given to the Dallas Cowboys. It should be a title that changes every year based on who does the best things for their country. And the Philadelphia Eagles were the absolute bastion of representing a nation in what I would perceive the right way. And so to see the team do the sort of Peterson stuff, get rid of the loud voices in the locker room, that I have to say I respect more than almost any sportsman that I follow. I mean, obviously I'm a massive Spurs fan, and someone like Harry Kane is my, you know, hero. But in terms of what people like Michael Bennett and Richard Sherman stand for, and Doug Baldwin, for certain, I have a lot more respect for them as humans than I do for any other, you know, player. So I did find that really frustrating to hear that about the Tennessee game and how they want to not have that to happen. You know, if the Seahawks got 0-16, but they carry themselves in the way that the Philadelphia Eagles did last year, you know, I would struggle to be any angry with the players for that, I have to say.
Yeah, if there's humanitarian awards in ESPYs or whatever umbrella that it falls under, Chris Long deserves a lot of them, because he's a white athlete in a fight in a cause which isn't really supposed to be fighting, but he does, and he did it in such a way which broke down barriers which the Seahawks seem to be putting up more than anything, even with people like Doug Baldwin still on the roster, which I think we've both said privately that it's going to be a player, a person, and a voice and a quote machine to watch with interest this year, isn't he, Doug Baldwin?
100%. You had Justin Britt, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with Michael Bennett. Those were great images, and I was proud of the team to see it. And you know, I get it. There are some people that don't think that politics should mix with sport. That is absolutely their prerogative. But I think that's reductive, because you know, everything in the world is linked intrinsically, and you shouldn't have to want to ignore the politics something if a sportsman wants to make a statement, because that's just not the way the world ticks around. So I was proud to see my players do that, and it's just disappointing that is what's being blamed, or not blamed, but in part seen as a reason why we weren't good last year, when there were so many obvious reasons schematically, effort-wise, performance-wise, injury-wise, that seems so much more obvious to explain why we were bad last year.
Yeah, so much more realistic as well, and fair as well. Talking of things which happened last year and happened since, Richard Sherman has made a few headlines this week as he, as Sporting Nation looking for clickbait, labelled it "Blast the Seahawks." He's saying that they've lost their way, and it's got some negative reactions from some Seahawks fans, because of course it has. But he has a point, but also he should shoulder some of the blame to a certain extent, because he was after Tennessee, as we just said, he might have been part of the problem at the same time. Or is that unfair?
I think he was probably the most scarred, from what I can tell, him and probably Cliff Averill, the most scarred publicly by what happened in Super Bowl 49. And I've said to you before that I don't think that's a situation that the players involved in that team are ever going to get over.
Yeah.
And maybe they should, because they're adults, but, you know, no fans gotten over it. You know, the fans can barely even listen to it. And, you know, when you think about the players' legacies that were involved and how these guys could be viewed in the future, I kind of understand why it sticks in their craw so much, and they just can't deal with it. And I think he's just so bitter about that whole situation that the idea of the Seahawks losing their way is probably just like a clickbaity soundbite to explain his thought process. I mean, I don't know if you heard Cliff Averill with Dave Damashek in about I want to say it must have been about May time, maybe June, where he said, you know, the play to, I don't think we've discussed this on the pod, have we? Because it was it was after the draft. I mean, he said, and if no one's listened to it, I urge you to go and dig it out. He said that with the ball not being handed off to Marshawn Lynch, a lot of the players started to question everything they've been told from the coaches in the past. And, they found it hard to sign up
to get back on board.
To get back on board with what Carroll was saying. Now, you can say rightly or wrongly, you know, that you can say that's right or wrong, but that's what they were feeling. And so I guess the idea of losing their way in inverted commas is as much, you know, that the players felt it maybe more than it actually was happening. But, you know, how many football coaches do we see lose their job because the players just aren't having it anymore? And unfortunately, if the players feel something like that, then that's it gets reflected in performance.
Yeah, the consistency of the players stop listening has been a thing with every pretty much everyone who has left. Avril's obviously said that. Sherman's basically said it every opportunity he got. And so Michael Bennett has, and I think there's been some interesting quotes come out of Michael Bennett's book, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. Is that what the book's called? Yeah, but the thing with the Sherman thing, when I read that, I was like, yeah, he's probably, that sounds about right, because they have lost their way. I mean, we talked about how they just want to keep with the run game. And, I mean, was it, as the saying goes, it, they're playing chess where everyone else plays checkers, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a bit disappointing that you've got Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay in our division, who just looks so young and vibrant, and they're trying different things, and we're sort of going back to something that doesn't actually seem like it works anymore. And we probably don't have that much talent by which to employ a controversial philosophy, but I guess we're stuck with it. And, you know, I wouldn't have been gutted if Carroll had gone with the rest of the coaches in February, but he hasn't. And so I guess we've got to crack on it and, you know, just see how it goes.
Yeah, it's a wait and see, but the leash is shortened quite considerably with their coach of this team for myself. Anything else Seahawks-wise has happened? The thing that happened yesterday. Earl Thomas went on his Instagram and has his he's quite emo, really, wasn't it? Saying, let's make a deal, if not, trade me. You said probably end of December was probably our end of season. I can't remember when the season ended. It's been quite a while. The team should trade him at the very first opportunity after the nonsense in Dallas. And it doesn't seem that the price they're going to get now is going to be in a different stratosphere to what they could have got 6-7 months ago, Adam.
So I watched a show 4 or 5 years ago, and it was Britain's number one fishmonger. And bear with me.
Sorry, ladies. Adam Nathan's engaged.
And what he did was he was going around fish markets around the world, the biggest fish markets around the world, and he was trying to make money based on what he knew from Billingsgate in London. Okay. And he was in Mexico, and he got absolutely stitched up with some jellied eels, I think, that he brought across. And he was about to make a huge loss, and he immediately sold them all. And his mantra was, if you're struggling in business, always take your first loss. Because if you don't take it, the next offer is going to be worse, and the next offer is going to be worse, and the next offer is going to be worse. And I remember in December, January, February, you had Seahawks fans saying, one first round pick for Earl Thomas. Are you mad? We should never take that. And now we're at the point where I think we're getting offered a fourth. Yeah. And ultimately, I just saw, you know, a tweet from Greg Bell, and he opens his article, if I can find it quickly, by saying, let's see if I can dig it out. I'm probably not going to find it now, which is very frustrating. I don't even know if I'm scrolling the right way. But he basically says, no, I am going to find it. I'm going to find it. Filibuster for me. Here we go. Earl Thomas issues online demand of extend my deal or trade me 1 week before camp. But the Seahawks ultimately still hold the leverage that will have Thomas returning to the team eventually. Now, that's all well and good, but the Seahawks just let Richard Sherman walk for nothing. They got a conditional seventh for Michael Bennett, something like that, that they've given up, I think, for Barkevious Mingo, who's taken up what they could have gotten for Sheldon Richardson, who's gone for nothing. Jimmy Graham, gone for nothing. Paul Richardson, gone for nothing. Cliff Avery and Cam Chancellor obviously gone for nothing. The team seems to have a problem with letting its former stars go for nothing. I mean, if you look at teams like the Patriots, who are always able to get a lot back for players that are aging, we have gotten hee-haw for all of these great players.
And, great word that is.
You know, great if Earl Thomas comes back and plays 9 games next season, and then he'll walk. And I don't know if you heard around the time of the draft, John Schneider was interviewed about Dwayne Brown, and he said, you know, we really want to extend him. We're looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And we need to talk down with him. And then Earl Thomas came up, and he was like, you know, we're counting on him. And that was it.
Yeah.
It's clearly not the intention to extend Earl Thomas's deal, because they don't see the value in doing it for the long-term thing. So if that was the case, why not just get rid of him? So that's what leaves me really confused. And so ends my fishmonger anecdote that I think worked quite magnificently in this situation, I have to say.
That was a long way around, but you kind of come back to the straight and narrow. Earl Thomas is an anomaly in every sense, every way you look at it. He's an anomaly. He's an anomaly of a player. He's an anomaly of importance to the Seahawks and how they line up and defensively. He's an anomaly to the importance of this team, this defense. Without Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett, Cam Chancellor, and Cliff Averill, moving into 2018, he's needed back there. But then at the same time, as you've just more eloquently put it, it probably is past its sell-by date that he probably shouldn't be a Seahawk at this juncture, because the deal, the price, as you say, the price they're going to get back from at this point is not what they could have got, and that is to the longer term detriment of the team. I mean, than paying him $14 million a year is going to be,
and they're absolutely not going to franchise tag him.
Let's he won't sign it. So it's just,
well, he might sign it, but they're not going to give him $17 million.
Well, Le'Veon Bell's been $14 million, so I can't imagine it's more than that, surely, safety.
Let's have a look. But is it a safety or is it a defensive back franchise tag?
It's probably safety.
Franchise tag 2018 fees.
But yeah, but
franchise tag. I'm looking up now. You keep talking. I'll find the figure.
But yeah, but he is an anomaly in every sense, and that is you could literally give both sides the argument to trade him or keep him or extend. You could give every what side of it, and it all makes sense because it's Earl Thomas, and for all the reasons I've just listed, that his importance to the team at this crossroads, which could either just completely capitulate, which, I suppose, I think it may this year.
So it's $11 million this year, so it's probably going to be around $12 million next year.
But I think it's Davis Sue. Obviously, it's not always the source of the most reliable information, but he said he made an interesting comparison to Ed Reed, who basically completely fell off a cliff after he turned 30, and Earl Thomas tells 30 in about 9 months' time, I think. So there's a completely understandable thing. I go back to our interview last year with John Moffitt, where he said that Pete Carroll doesn't like 30-year-olds. I mean, this offseason is showing that to a T, isn't it? Michael Bennett, John Ryan's been given the biggest competition he's had in Seattle, and then Earl Thomas is getting to that age threshold, and they seem as reluctant as ever to pay him. But is it a case after Marshawn Lynch, when they paid him $12 million and he just wasn't Marshawn Lynch of the year before, and obviously they paid Cam Chancellor and he's gone within 15 months, obviously no fault of his own. Do you think they've just been burnt one too many times? Do you think that's a consideration at this point? Or
yeah, I mean, the problem is that I've said for quite a while is that I don't really think any person in this deal has a lot of leverage, because the Seahawks own his rights and could feasibly franchise tag him, but Thomas is the kind of guy that I would imagine he would hold out of games, no problem. He would have no problems doing that.
Yeah.
So the Seahawks don't have a ton of leverage there. He is going to be 30, and no team has clearly been that desperate to get hold of him when he's on the trading block, because they know about his new deal. So they're going to have to pay that deal anyway. So Thomas doesn't have that much leverage, because no team seems to want him that badly. And a new team isn't going to want to give him, I wouldn't have thought, a 4-year, $60 million deal or something along those lines. So I just feel there's just a complete impasse here, in which, you know, the team are good in the sense that they've, you know, same with Richard Sherman, you know, they wanted to let him have his own chance to talk to teams, and Deshaun shared they wanted to give him the chance. But someone like Sherman should have been dealt outside the division. Like, you have to be ruthless at times. And I think Thomas just should have been dealt. Just get what you can for him, because, yeah, as I say, the offer that you're going to get back from him is not going to improve, and it's certainly not going to get better now that we know he's holding out and every week is going to start bleating about how he wants to be traded.
Yeah, I agree. It's just this. Yeah, it's just all a bit tedious at this point, isn't it?
Yeah. I said to you yesterday, Earl Thomas with a number of Zs, because it's just boring, and like, he's overly emotional, which is boring, and I just want a resolution to it now. And, you know, who am I? I'm just a stupid fan. But I think everyone just sort of feels like, ugh, can we just get this over with?
In the same
way as, sadly, Chancellor and Averill, it seemed inevitable they were going to have to retire. This whole Thomas thing seems inevitable that he's going to play for another team next season at some point, and I just sort of want it done.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, we're about 10 days away from training camp. There's no way Earl Thomas is in Seattle in 10 days. Other NFL news, as I said earlier, most of the players who were franchise tagged did not sign their deals. Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when, if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways, which he is, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the proverbial bin needs loads of people in it at the minute. you know, Bell's in the unfortunate position of being in a position which, or playing in a position which just is not that highly rated anymore. And unfortunately for him, the basic statistics of points per game, the Steelers score more points in games without him than with him. So whilst he is absolute magic on the field, passing and catching and throwing is more important. And so I kind of get why they don't want to commit huge money to a guy who you don't know when he's going to fall off a cliff, because his position that he plays in would suggest that he hasn't got that much longer left at the top level.
Completely. I mean, who was the last running back who was paid big? It must have been Peterson.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, Marshall Lynch, I guess, look what happened there. He retired like 8 months later. And we all thought Thomas Rawls was Barry Sanders.
Yeah. Obviously, he is a generationally good running back. So if you are going to do it for anyone, do it for him. But yeah. I think the Steelers, in getting franchise tag and whatever, if they can get 2 years from him on the tag and the way he's played, and then they get rid of him.
Yeah.
You know, Ben's probably got one more year left at the top level. So, you've got to keep the band together this year, and they've done that, which is good.
Yeah.
And, you know, they may have to just move on from a couple of things next year, but at least they'll be well stocked to do it with cap space.
Yeah, and 2019, they're going to have, 2019-2020, they're going to have Mason Rudolph and a new running back along with Antonio Brown, because he shows no signs of going anywhere or slowing down. Well, you mentioned it, so we might as well dive on in. Proverbial bin, obviously it's been 6 months, so we've probably got a few people to get in there. Anyone else, Sean, chuck on in there? We're going to do some audio, some production for this as well before the season kicks off again. But anyone proverbial bin, or any few in the proverbial bin?
I'll let you go first so I can have a quick think, because I hadn't really thought about it.
Obviously, everyone has their issues, and I don't know what he deals with is obviously the stresses of the job and all that. But Steve Keim, what are you doing? you're in charge of a team which is window closed at a rate more rapid than the Seahawks one appears to have. You've managed to convince somehow, I'm not even sure how, Larry Fitzgerald to stick around for the last couple of years while Carson Palmer's body is just disintegrated in the desert, and then you go and get bust and suspended for 6 games he's been suspended for. I don't know how the league can suspend a general manager. I'm not too sure what that means.
5 weeks from now.
Okay, I literally thought he wasn't allowed in the stadium for like the first 5 games or something. So that's, I mean, yeah. But what are you doing? I mean, it's probably harsh because obviously he's going through something and all that stuff before we get any Twitter comments. Lol, what we're going to get is Twitter comments. But yeah, Steve Keim in the bin.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in
there. well, it is okay. It is the Hugh Jackson segment of the show.
I've ever been sponsored by Hugh Jackson.
Yeah.
Who can we put in there? No one's had a dig at the Seahawks apart from me, so I guess I could put myself in there. Would be well deserved and long overdue to, I'm sure, a number of listeners. I mean, the Rams have just given Brandon Cooks $80 million over 5 years.
Before Aaron Donald.
And they've paid Ndamukong Suh, and they've not paid Aaron Donald. So
keep doing.
Maybe the ghost of Jeff Fisher looms large, and they do vaguely remain. Infantino. Incognito, Richie Incognito. He's been a bit of a bell end over the last few months, you know, trying to get out of Buffalo and then now unretiring to try and get a new team. That pisses me off.
I'm not certain how legitimate or how, like, if it was from the Onion account or something, but I'm pretty certain Richie Incognito has been appointed to an anti-bullying board, which is just the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, that is.
Jonathan Martin stuff. yeah.
I think I'll do our listeners a favour here, and I'll put NFL UK in a rather large proverbial bin for, you know, what can only be described as a bit of a farcical situation with the tickets for the Spurs Stadium for the Oakland Raiders Seahawks game. There's obviously thousands of us who are absolutely desperate to see our team play, and whilst I understand that there are issues that are beyond anyone's control, it's just very disappointing that fans have been left in the lurch to the degree they are with the tickets, and to the point where, you know, we've seen American fans who were supposed to come over for the game cancel their trip because they're not sure they can get a ticket. I'm of the view, maybe naively, but it's based on going to Seattle a lot and getting a lot of tickets on the secondary market, that if you want a ticket badly enough, you will get a ticket for a not absurd price. It will be expensive, and who am I to tell you what is and isn't expensive based on what your budget is? But, you know, a lot of us have shelled out maybe £500 for corporate tickets today. I would imagine that's the barometer you're looking at when you're talking about general, secondary market tickets up in the gods somewhere. But it's pretty disappointing that for a game featuring two teams coming over for the first time, they've made such a balls up of the tickets and have hindered so many people's travel plans. But the weekend's going to be belting either way, game or not. You know, we could be out of the playoffs by that stage anyway, so just stay and get pissed in the pub anyway.
the little drabs and drips and drabs of information I've got about that weekend, it is going to be quite a weekend. And yeah, it's just a lack of foresight from, I mean, the NFL UK, despite having the NFL, the three first letters of their company name, it is a really small organization. It's basically on one floor of an office in London, I believe. I've been told that by a few different people. So they've clearly just pushed something maybe too soon with the Spurs Stadium not obviously being ready till end of the month, is it, Adam? Or mid August?
I think it's the first game currently planned.
It's just a lack of foresight to rush a game through when the stadium isn't going to be ready. It was never going to be ready in February, was it? So
no.
it's just a bit of a lack of foresight, and then just complete disregard of, as you say, people making travel plans from the West Coast. I mean, because West Coast teams, of all the West Coast teams, you're probably hard-pressed to find a better supported team on the road than Seattle and Oakland. I mean, we saw 4 or 5 years ago when we first met in Seattle, the Raiders fans who made the trip down. I mean, me and you did a tour of Safeco with a couple of Raiders fans, didn't we?
Yeah, they were all over the place. They traveled in fantastic numbers.
Yeah, so it's just like a foresight, which is just a bit frustrating. But if you are able to, if you have booked, I would encourage you not to cancel if you can justify it, obviously, because as Terry Peppard, the noted scholar, said earlier, that the weekend is more about seeing people, meeting people, socialising with the Seahawkers and the Seahawks at certain junctures as well, possibly more than the game. And as we've seen with recent trips to Seattle, we've been lucky enough to make and being lucky enough to be part of. It's not always just about the game, is it? Obviously, the last trip to Seattle was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, this will sound trite, and you know, people will say, "Oh, well, you can say that because you've seen the team play before." I've never wanted a tailgate to finish so I can go into the stadium and watch the game. The best fun always happens outside the ground. Yeah. You've got fireball on your head, whether that be in liquid or bottle form, and it's a riot. And honestly, I do think people will look back on the weekend and say that the Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning, you know, you're not going to want those to end. And as great as it will be to go into the stadium and hear the anthems and see the teams run out and, you know, see us being third and 17 27 times on the day, you're going to have more fun outside the game than you are inside. So I do encourage people as best they can to still make the trip and have a look at the fantastic opportunities and plans that people have made and gone to a lot of trouble to do.
Yeah. I'll wholeheartedly agree. And if you do get a ticket, it does appear, and Adam's going to love me saying this, it does to be in quite an arena at the new White Hart Lane or whatever they're going to end up calling it, doesn't it? I mean, obviously you drove past there yesterday. It's quite a sight, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like a spaceship landed in a town. It doesn't really fit the area particularly well, which isn't a criticism, it's just a comment. But it's going to be a heck of a place to be inside once it's all completed.
Yeah, and obviously hospitality tickets did go on sale and were snapped up remarkably quickly earlier today. We're recording this Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. Next sale, I think, is for Wembley Scene Ticket Holders, which is September 3rd, or general sale September 3rd, which is just the most ridiculous thing. The season starts 5 days later. Anything else NFL-wise has caught your attention over the last 5-6 months, Adam?
No, I think we're good for the minute. You've obviously got the Tom Brady saga. He doesn't seem that happy with what's going on in New England, but I don't think that's really enough to warrant a discussion. Is it worth mentioning the charity partners we've got for the weekend?
Yeah, obviously with London, with the chapter this year, in the last couple of years, we do have some chapter charities, Archie Smile and the SSAFA. I think I've got that acronym right. It's always a bit of a tongue twister, especially at 1:30 in the morning. They will be there. We will be raising money for them with auctions and raffles at Leadenhall in Revolution in Leadenhall. Leadenhall, Adam, you're a Londoner.
Something Hall, mate.
Yeah. On the Saturday night, tickets are still available. There's a lot of Germans coming over, so we need to get the UK British representation up. A couple of weeks ago, if you may or may not have read, Greg Bishop from Sports Illustrated wrote a pretty cool, pretty interesting, and pretty heartbreaking article on around the death of Washington State quarterback Tyler Helinski. Helinski was found dead 6 months ago yesterday on the 16th of June, and since then his family have chased up and wanted to find out the reasons why. One of those was donating his body to research around CTE, which discovered that the 21-year-old Helinski had a brain, which is something we obviously mentioned with Cam Chancellor, of a 50 or 60-year-old, and possibly played a part in the events which led to his untimely death. With that, his family, spearheaded by Tyler's mum, Kim, have set up the foundation Helinski's Hope, which is to provide support to college campuses across America and Canada, I believe. I'm not too sure on that. With student athletes suffering with any mental health issues or in need support of anything with pressures from curriculum or sport activities. With that in mind, we sent a bit of a long shot email a few weeks ago to the foundation after that Sports Illustrated article, and we did announce last week that we are getting wristbands, t-shirts, hoodies, t-shirts in men's and women's sizes and designs, including a special Seahawks coloured scheme wristband from the foundation, which will be sold, raffled and auctioned off over the weekend, with all proceeds from those sales and from those raffles and from those auction bits going straight towards Helinski's Hope. The story got the attention of Steve Rabel, Greg Bishop, who wrote the article as well, and the best part of last week really was seeing it on John Boyle's Seahawks.com weekly roundup. So yeah, if you are coming to London, if you are still coming to London, donate anything if you want to, but come with deep pockets, come with overflowing wallets and help us support, which is, I think you'd agree, a pretty cool foundation, a pretty cool cause to support. A massive thanks to Kim and the Helinski family for allowing us to do this. And it's pretty cool email thread going on in my inbox last couple of weeks.
I can imagine, yeah, it's a fantastic cause. Come thirsty and come with deep pockets, and hopefully we can make put those two things together and raise a shedload of money for a more than worthy cause.
Yeah, and obviously Washington State is the team, the university Tyler went to. So it's not the top college on our watch list, is it, Adam? But when it comes to things like this, it kind of breaks down all those kind of borders, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Needless to be said.
Yeah, yeah. So the tickets are still available. They will be going on general sale in the next couple of weeks. £25 a pop. I think that includes a drink on arrival and obviously all the shenanigans which happen at a UK Seahawkers event. And then there is also a limited run of T-shirts available, £15. I'll post all the information up on Facebook or Twitter once they go on general sale. We've had about 60 orders of them. I think we're at about 350. We've got about 200, 250 tickets left for the actual event. So if you are still coming, please be aware of the open up of the general sale. If you are a US member, you should have received an email from your chapter head. But yeah, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, there'll be a few changes coming to this podcast in the next few weeks and months. One of them is that we will be shutting down the Patreon part while we rebuild and kind of get back on a regular schedule. There'll be more news coming regarding the podcast on our next pod, hopefully. So yeah, for anyone who has signed up on Patreon over the last couple of years, we're entering our third season, Adam. That's a bit weird, isn't it?
Wild news.
So if anyone who has supported us on Patreon, massive thanks. We will look to set that up probably again a bit on down the future, but in the coming days and weeks, that will be shut down. If you want to get in touch with the chapter on Twitter, you can at Seahawkers UK. Facebook, which is pretty active at the minute regarding tickets, which people seem to just realise that you can actually make the flight to Seattle, which is quite enjoyable. Is UK Seattle Seahawks fans. The website is ukseahawkers.com. The podcast, the Pedestrian Podcast, is on Podbean. Myself is at Stu_Court on Twitter, at Adam Dean Nathan, and Ross is at RossBell1984. Also, one more thing on podcasts. The guys, Brandon and Adam. How did I forget that name? Brandon and Adam are again up for a podcast award. So if you have the opportunity, go on their Twitter, go on their website and vote for them, because they are two stand-up chaps and do produce on a more consistent basis than we do a pretty damn good podcast. So
more regular. Always work. More regular.
Regular, yes, yeah.
Regular, yeah. Forever in our shadow, but more regular.
Anything else? I think that's everything, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've done enough. Yeah. It's 1:30 and I could do it in my bed.
Yeah, so until next time, probably in a couple of weeks, enjoy it's still currently dry, I think. It was when I walked in the house a couple of hours ago. This has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawk.
In a long time. He is highly skilled. Tyler Hilinski keeping the play alive. Hilinski. Touchdown. Again, the Cougars find the end zone.
The sweetest son. The best friend. The best brother. I think sweet is always that adjective that you'll use to describe Tyler, right? He kind and good, and everything you hear about him is very true. He always had a kind word for someone, didn't want anybody in the room to be unhappy, and that included when you guys were younger and growing up. He just wanted to make sure that everybody was fine and everybody was good. He was fierce and loyal, and he loved football.
That is going to do it. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks Super Bowl 48 champions.